Hello, we couldn't help but wonder, listeners. Seeing as we have a while before And Just Like That is back, Elise and I wanted to give you a listen to another project we've been working on. We couldn't help but wonder, still wondering. There, we discuss New York City-based rom-coms like When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, Hitch, Trainwreck, Bros, Serendipity, Ghost. We cheat a little bit with Sleeps in Seattle, but also bonus episodes where we answer questions and do quick breakdowns of films like An Affair to Remember. We break them into 3 to 4 episodes, so the first episodes that we're going to share here are not spoilery at all. We hope you enjoy. Welcome to Still Wondering, Ghost, Part 1. Well, hey, Elise Castle.
Hey, Mike Jensen.
How are you doing today?
I am very good. I am very excited to talk about this movie because for 2 reasons. Number one, much to my friend Jeff's, I don't know what the thing is. He doesn't agree that this is a romantic comedy, but it is very romantic, and it is a comedy, so it is a romantic comedy. But what I'm excited to talk about with this movie is 2 things. Number one, I've never seen it before. And so I was genuinely surprised at like the plot twists and turns. So that was fun. It felt like old Sex and the City days. And I liked that it was romantic and a comedy and set in New York, but it's different than what we've done. It's not following all the same, like, and this, and this, and this. So that was fun for me.
Yeah, when you mentioned us, because it was your idea to do this film next.
Right.
I had kind of like taken the reins for the first half of the season. And then you suggested Ghost. And I thought it was a funny selection only because I was very aware that it's not really a romantic comedy. In fact, I used the term paranormal romance, which you thought was funny. But I don't think that I made that up. I think that it's regarded as a paranormal romance.
Yeah. I think I meant it more as like, not necessarily the phrase was funny. I mean, it is funny, but like paranormal romances are hilarious.
Yeah, so I knew we were going down kind of a different road, but I think it's fun. I think it's like a fun sort of, you know, a change up from what we've been doing thus far.
Oh, I think it's perfect. And I think it's like a great thing for us to talk about because it's so classic. And it was the highest grossing film in 1990. I know that much.
Well, until Home Alone came along and then dethroned it. But, you know.
Which is our next romantic comedy.
Our next romantic comedy, Home Alone. So your relationship to the film was that you'd never seen it before.
I had never seen it before. My only things I know about Ghost are the scene, like the infamous pottery scene, because I was in a sketch comedy group that we like had a sketch that kind of used that. Along with 900 other comedic things in the world. And I knew the musical. I'd never seen the musical, but I knew the song With You because I've heard it sung a million times. That's all I know.
I don't think that I know that song. I mean, the only thing that I know of the musical was the clip they did at the Tonys, which my memory was mostly Unchained Melody. I think they did something else too, but
yeah, I mean, I'm sure they would do that at the Tonys because it's Unchained Melody. I think there's a spot in here when we're talking that I want you to put the clip of With You for a minute, because it's like when I heard her say these lines, I thought, oh my gosh, that's almost word for word what the lines are in With You.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I suppose in an interesting twist that makes this particularly timely was that I believe that I'm correct in that the actress who played Oda Mae Brown was Davine Joy Randolph, who won the Golden Globe last night for her performance in The Holdovers.
Congratulations.
She was so good. I mean, that category is stupid this year. Like, every actress in that category is brilliant. It gives an amazing performance. And I'm very torn. But, like, oh, man, she's so good. She's so good in every, like, I've been a fan of hers for, like, years now. And I'm really sad that I didn't see her in Ghost the Musical. I would have loved to have seen.
What else was she in?
She was in, oh, gosh, you're putting me on the spot.
That's okay. You don't have to.
She was in, the first thing that I remember seeing her in was a movie called Dolomite Is My Name.
Okay.
Which was an Eddie Murphy film from a while back. I think, like, 2019. And then, yeah, she's just done, oh, she's in Only Murders in the Building. She's the detective in Only Murders in the Building.
Okay. Oh, okay.
She's just so good. Like, she was in Rustin, which came out this year. Anyways, she's an amazing actress, and it's very exciting that she's, like, getting her due right now.
Well, I'm not. Basically, what I'm going to say is there may be a good chance that I refer to Whoopi Goldberg's character in this movie as Murphy Brown. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay, sure.
Because right. How my brain works.
So I didn't see this in the movie theater, but I definitely saw it around the time that it came out. And I feel like I saw it
I'm almost positive my dad was there, because we'll get to a particular scene where I remember his reaction as we were watching it. But I haven't seen it in forever. I haven't seen it in literally decades. So it was interesting watching it again, kind of knowing what was going to happen, but like not really remembering how we got there. So anyways, here we are. We're talking about ghosts.
Yeah, I was going to say, in case we haven't mentioned it yet, everyone, this is ghosts that we're talking about. Everyone's like, is this Titanic? No, it's Ghost.
The famous New York romance Titanic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Ghost was written by Bruce Joel Rubin. He had done a couple of films, but nothing big. He had done like a movie called Brainstorm and a movie called Deadly Friend. So kind of feels like sort of B-movie horror-ish kind of films. And then it was directed by Jerry Zucker, who was famous for, you know, Airplane and Top Secret and Ruthless People. Like, he had done very broad comedies, mostly with, I think he'd worked always with Jim Abrams and David Zucker, his brother. Like, I think that, like, they were like a team that had sort of written and directed these kind of iconic comedies that had come along. Bruce Rubin tells a very long story that I will try to encapsulate as quickly as possible, but he'd always wanted to write a story about ghosts, but he thought it would be more interesting to tell the story from the point of view of the ghost, not of people that would be like afraid of them. And he tells a story about graduating from college in New York and seeing like those flyers that they would have for like, we're hiring it. It was a news, like ABC News or something like that. And he took the entire stack because he didn't want anyone else to apply for the job. And he ended up getting this job, and he sort of got into this newsroom where he realized that everyone had been there for like 20 years, that this wasn't a stopover job. This was like the job that you got that you would eventually retire from. And he knew that it wasn't what he wanted to do. So after working there for a little bit, he let them know that he was quitting. And he left that job and he decided to take a bunch of books and go to Greece and just read. But when he got there, he was sort of overwhelmed by all of the books that he'd brought and like didn't know if this was the right path for him. So he ended up hitchhiking, which don't do that.
Should someone tell him about libraries?
I know,
like,
right?
You don't have to go to Greece. You can just...
I think he thought it would be very like, you know, like that's what you do when you're in your 20s.
He was
finding
himself.
Leave it all behind. Yeah. Right, exactly. So he ended up hitchhiking all through Europe and like all through, like he talked about going through all the Middle East and like how you could just hitchhike through like Afghanistan. And he ended up in Tibet. I know, like it sounds all terrifying now, but also just hitchhiking is terrifying. Don't do that. And he ended up in Tibet, and he ended up at like with a bunch of like at a monastery where he ended up living with Tibetan monks for some period of time. And he just sort of like lived there and thought of stories. And this was kind of one of the stories that he thought about, also with a little Hamlet thrown in, which I think we'll get to eventually. And he talks about how he had, you know, like shopped this script around and no one was really biting. And he was looking at like a Spielberg or like he wanted like a grand director to, obviously anyone that writes something is like, this will be a huge director is going to take this. And when he found out that it was going to be Jerry Zucker, he says that he cried. And I don't know if that's true or not, but he was very fearful that they were going to turn it into a comedy, that he had written what he thought was a serious film with comedy, but that he were going to make it like, because Beetlejuice had just come out. And he thought, oh, they're going to make it, which for the record, I love Beetlejuice. But he was worried that like that was the direction they were going to go with it. And he tells the story about being in a meeting where executives were telling him like this was the best script, like the script was perfect. And then talks about being just sort of in the Hollywood, like being in a Hollywood lot and hearing someone talking to another writer and also telling them that their script was the best script and that it was perfect. And that when he ended up meeting with Jerry Zucker, Jerry had notes. And so if we kind of like, which sort of made him think like, all right, he's at least taking this seriously. So if we switch perspectives for a minute, so Jerry Zucker was working on the Naked Gun film, and basically all three of them, like I said, him and Jim Abrams and David Zucker, had all decided that whatever they were going to do next, they were going to do separately. That they were going to, not that they were never going to work together again, but that for their next projects, they should each three go their separate ways. So Jerry Zucker was having lunch with Lindsay Durand, who at the moment was working at Paramount. And he sort of just asked, like, what are the scripts that you're looking at right now? Like, I'm looking for something to direct. What do you have? And she mentioned a bunch of scripts and then brought up Ghost. And Ghost, that she thought was, like, the best script that was being shopped around right now, but that it wasn't really for him because it wasn't a comedy. And, you know, he said, that's great. Like, I don't necessarily want to do a comedy next. And he talks about how he took the script home and then didn't read it. Like, he took the script home and, like, set it on his bedside and then just never picked it up. And eventually his wife picked it up. And his wife read through it and said, you have to make this film. Like, this is going to be a great film. And he talks about reading it and thinking that it was fine. Like, not necessarily being as taken with it as everyone else was, but thinking, like, no, I think there's something here. But immediately, like I said, he had notes, like he had revisions that he thought would make it work better. And that sort of told him, well, if I'm thinking about revisions and I'm thinking about notes, that means that I care about it. It means that I'm already invested in this script. And they both tell the story of how over the course of like the next 6 to 8 months, there were 19 different drafts of this film that Jerry kept having notes for it. Jerry tells it as a very exciting story that it was really fun. And like the notes were fun and like seeing new rewrites were fun. And of course, Bruce Rubin talks about what a nightmare it was, that it was just like, cause we've written things before and you write this thing and you're like, well, this is going to be perfect. And then you get notes and you're like, well, then I'm done. Like, what am I doing with my life?
It just happened last month to me.
Yeah, it happens. Like when you write something and then you get a note and you're like, what? It's not perfect. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you know, 18 times he rewrote this thing until they finally landed basically on the script that we have here, which brings us to the film. And I suppose one of the things that I didn't remember is that there is that interesting, like, title sequence flash as we get, like, ghost, and it's sort of scary.
Yeah, I mean, my first thing I wrote down, mind you, once again, everyone, I'm coming in this knowing very little. The internet told me it was a romantic comedy based in New York. That's kind of all I know. So the first thing I wrote is very scary intro. Is this the right movie? And then I see the name Patrick Swayze and I go, Patrick Swayze. Okay, it is. We are in a spooky attic. Everything is covered in plastic?
Yeah, and I think because I sort of knew the film, and it's funny that just like a week ago, I was sort of walking through Soho and I had that thought of like, someone 40 years ago, like, bought that space when it wasn't worth anything, and now it's worth millions of dollars. So I think because I had just been in Soho, and because I had a vague memory of the film, I was like, oh, I think we're in a Soho loft. I think that we're in a Soho loft that hasn't been remodeled yet, and we sort of get light filtering in, and it's all very dusty. And I wrote, we go from creepy and ominous to sort of peaceful as the music sort of transitions.
My next lines are, everything is covered in plastic. The music isn't scary now. This is very Edward Scissorhands-y. Like, it went from, like, being scary to, like, the snow scene in Edward Scissorhands. Like, less scary and more light.
I will say that ever since watching this, I think I watched it, like, 2 days ago, I just get that, like, do 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 do, and then it modulates do do do, and just go, like, literally be in my head for like hours on end. It's very catchy.
Well, you had a better idea of where we were than I do, because I said, are we on an archaeological dig?
Yeah, and then we get someone breaking through, and we sort of see as we reveal there are three stars.
Yes, well, I don't know that. I just write, Demi and Men are renovating a space.
Yeah, we have Patrick Swayze. He had, you know, he'd done The Outsiders and Red Dawn, and then Roadhouse and Dirty Dancing, I think, are the two that had come out really recently that had sort of catapulted him into fame.
I have never seen any of those. Including
You've never
Dirty,
seen Dirty Dancing.
Yeah, I know.
That's wild. Yeah. You know what's so funny? I don't know that I've ever sat and watched Dirty Dancing from beginning to end. Like, I feel like I've seen the whole thing, but I'm not sure I've ever, like, had the experience, because I don't think that I was allowed to watch it when it came out, because it was, you know, Dirty Dancing.
Which feels weird, because I feel like you've said before your parents kind of let you watch a lot of our movies.
It's very back and forth. Like, the things that I was allowed to watch, I think that I was allowed to watch them if my parents wanted to watch
them.
Well,
you could watch, it sounds like maybe you were allowed to watch, like, murder, but not sex. Like, you can watch horror movies, but no love.
That's a very accurate depiction of the situation, and also like what gets a worse rating. That like you can have as violent as you want, but like one sex scene and it's an R-rated film. And I also had loved Red Dawn. It was a film that when I was a little kid I watched many, many times. They tried to remake it recently and I kind of knew it wasn't going to work. I also loved The Outsiders. Like I can still recite much of that
movie. Which is going to be a musical.
Yeah, upcoming Broadway musical. And they do talk about how both Tom Cruise and Harrison Ford had turned this role down. A lot of stars had turned this role down. And they sort of talked about how they understood, because it could feel like a very passive role. Like you're playing a dead guy. Mm-hmm. Like you don't really get to move the plot along all that much. And Bruce talks about seeing Patrick Swayze on the Barbara Walters show and him crying about his father. His father had recently passed away. And thinking like, if this tough guy can get on TV and cry, I think that he's right for the role. And Jerry talks about thinking that he wasn't right for it even after meeting with him. That, like, this isn't the right guy. He'd seen Roadhouse. Like, this isn't the guy to play the part. But ended up getting a call from Nicole David, who I believe is Patrick Swayze's agent or manager. She doesn't have a lot of credits, but she is on a documentary about Patrick Swayze. And basically just saying, like, can he just come in and read for it? And Jerry was like, he's not going to get the part, but I'm not going to tell him no. Like, he can certainly come in and read for the part. And the funniest thing about that is that in the commentary, which is where I got this from, it's revealed that the reason why Nicole David called Jerry was because Bruce had called Nicole David to be like, call Jerry and just ask to read. And Jerry Zucker didn't know that until the night before they recorded the commentary, when Bruce was like, hey, this is going to come up tomorrow. I need you to know, like 10 years later, the reason why she called is because I wanted him so desperately for the role that I had her call you, which I thought was like kind of a funny reveal that they were like, I'd kept this secret for 10 years, but it was time that you know the truth. And that, you know, the reading basically convinced him that this was the guy to do it.
Am I wrong in saying that Bruce Willis also wanted to do it?
Oh, he did not want to do it. They offered it to him and he also turned it down, even though Demi Moore was going to do it.
Right.
He was like, this isn't the role for me. I'm not right for it. Yeah, this was turned down by like about a dozen big Hollywood stars.
Okay.
And then, you know, speaking of Demi Moore, like she had done St. Elmo's Fire and About Last Night, but she wasn't really a star yet. And they actually, the role almost went to Nicole Kidman, which becomes more of a funny story later, that like Nicole Kidman had done a taped reading and had like sent a video in, and they were kind of deciding between the two of them and ended up going with Demi Moore. But, you know, certainly like this is what's going to shoot Demi Moore into superstardom. And then you have Tony Goldwyn, who had mostly done TV. Like he'd mostly done little TV roles here and there, and he had done Friday the 13th Part 6. And he was actually married to Jane Muskie, who is the production designer. She was already the production designer for this film. And in fact, this was her follow-up to When Harry Met Sally. And she would later on do Hitch. So she's all over our show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that she's the one that brought up her husband and was like, I think that my husband, Tony, would be good for this. And they watched a video and were kind of like, yeah, he seems fine. But then it just stayed with them. They were like, all right, let's bring him in and read him. And he ended up just fitting in. They needed someone who you would think is the good guy, but spoiler alert, can also play the bad guy.
And something interesting I found out was that Demi Moore auditioned for this role with long hair and then just cut it before they started shooting without speaking to anybody.
Yeah, Jerry Zucker tells the story of Demi Moore showing up on set with that short hair and like being really upset. Not like he was going to yell at her, but being like, she cut her hair off. Like, this short hair looks kind of ridiculous. Like, he didn't like it. Like, he didn't think it looked good until they started videotaping it. And that as soon as he saw it on screen, he was like, oh, no. This is going to work. This is going to be great. Because he also tells about the fact that Demi Moore had cut her hair so short without telling anyone or asking permission. But prior to filming, Patrick Swayze had grown his hair out really long because they didn't know what hairdo they wanted to land on with him. So you had like the female protagonist with this super short hair and the male protagonist with this really long hair. And he was like, it just looked opposite. Like it just looked wrong. And then of course they ended up cutting Patrick's hair a certain amount and it all looks great in the end. And I feel like this haircut became very, very iconic at the time.
No, it did. People would go to the salon and at the time they were calling it the boy cut. They were asking for
the
boycott. And Demi's daughter recently cut her hair similar to that.
Yeah, it looks very cute.
Whoa, look. Hey, it's an Indian head penny. 1898. It's a good omen.
You're the good omen.
Once again, like, I tend to, like, look something up, and then an hour later, I'm like, I have to stop reading about pennies. Because we could do an entire podcast about the penny. It's worth about $2, though one went for $161,000 in 2012, so I'm not exactly sure what that price range is. It's a very large price range. It's also worth noting that one of Bruce Rubin's job before he became a writer was actually tearing down loft spaces in New York, which is where this imagery came from. When he started thinking about the film, he remembered the look of like the sunlight coming through the dusty windows and all of that. So that's sort of where this imagery originated from. There is a moment that I suppose is foreshadowing where we hear the character that Tony Goldwyn plays saying you could sell this place tomorrow and double your money, and Demi Moore having the line of like, you're obsessed, sort of like you're obsessed with money, which I guess is a little bit of like a, something more is going on here. But of course, if you don't know, you don't catch that at all.
Yeah, and I didn't really know exactly. Also, this scene reminded me of when you and I worked in a restaurant that was moving to a bigger space and they were renovating the smaller space. And I'm not sure if you were there or not that day when the owner was like knocking down the wall with a hammer being like, I think there's exposed brick somewhere.
I do. I definitely remember that. Yeah.
And we were like, what is happening? But I mean, that's like a real New York moment when you're renovating. Because if you find an exposed brick wall, like that really helps.
Like, why did we cover this up in the first place?
Right. One thing I was confused about here is like, what is happening with Carl? We find out his name is Carl, the friend, because they start kissing, Demi and Patrick, because I don't know if we know their names yet, but they start kissing. And I'm like, why are you making out in front of Carl? Unless you're in a throuple. In that case, we don't shame. But it just, I wasn't sure what their relationship was to each other here.
Yeah. And we sort of find out in the next scene, because now we're in the financial district and we're on Broad Street at the New York Stock Exchange, and we scheduled a talk, and Sam is speaking in Japanese, so I don't know if we know his name is Sam at this
point.
We
do, because now we do, because I've started writing Sam, and I have that Sam is on his way to pitch to the Japanese guys.
And we have a comment about a Swedish pom-pom girl joke, which I kind of would like to hear that joke, but it's probably not good.
Yeah, probably, no, probably best you didn't.
And then are we complimenting his suspenders? He sort of like shows, like, oh, Molly got these.
I wasn't sure what it was, if it was, I thought maybe it was like cufflinks, but who knows what it is.
Yeah, I wasn't 100%
He, like,
certain.
Vaguely points to something on Sam.
And then is like, Molly got these.
So these, yeah. Maybe he's talking about, like, his underwear, and we just can't see it.
And then there's a very fancy car. It's a Testarossa.
Ooh, that sounds like a buffet.
And it's a Ferrari. So Ferrari produced these cars from 1984 to 1996. There are less than 10,000 of them. They are very, very expensive. And then I guess, once again, if you know where this is going, there is the comment that Sam says to Carl of, like, I think you better pay your Mustang off first.
Well, that's good that there's a lot of stuff, because I still, until the end of the film, don't really know what their jobs are. But that's okay.
We're going to get there for me as well. I have a few of those. Because now we're on the elevator. Yeah. And like, do you think this joke was funny then?
No. I mean, I didn't really get it. So Carl's making this thing happen where he's like, they're in an elevator and Carl starts coughing. And then they start joking about Carl, but not joking like anyone else would know. They're just talking loudly about Carl having a contagious virus and maybe rashy genitals just to make everyone in the elevator uncomfortable.
Yeah, it doesn't, I don't know if it played better in 1990.
I mean, could you imagine doing that now in like a post-COVID world?
I feel like you would just be killed in the elevator.
The other day when we were coming home on the plane, and we were on New Jersey Transit, and it was like a packed train car, and Mark just wasn't thinking, and the ending of the story is he wasn't sick. We were just exhausted. So nobody was harmed in the telling of the story. But he goes loudly. He's like, I think I'm getting sick. And I just look at him and I'm like, we're in this packed train car. We're stuck with these people because there's been a delay. And now you just loudly announce that you're getting sick. So I just went, well, then put on a mask. And then he put on a mask and just sat there. But God.
Yeah. And then we have Carl, Sam, and then Susan looking good. So Sam is canceled.
Yeah. Sam and Carl enter the office, which is strangely carpeted. I mean, strangely for my 2023 eye, but in 1990, I guess that bright blue carpet was fine. And then Sam inappropriately greets Susie.
And Rose lets Sam know that the Kobayashi people are already here. Mm-hmm.
And we find out that Dylan needs $900,000 in his account by 10 in Albany. I don't know what Carl or Sam do.
Yeah, and I definitely had a few moments in this of like, wait, there wasn't an internet yet. So I don't know how a lot of this stuff works.
Me neither. I mean, was there not internet yet at all?
I don't think in 1990. Well, I guess the first time that I remember internet being mentioned was in 1992. So perhaps there was some kind of...
January 1st, 1983 is the official birthday of the internet. The internet went public in 1993. People started using it in like the 80s. So probably there was different networks that bankers could use.
Some form of it. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. I will say they talk about Carl needing Sam's MAC code.
Sure.
And MAC stands for message authorizing code. So it is like saying an ATM machine.
Yeah, and at the moment I thought he was asking for like his discount code to use at MAC Cosmetics.
For sure.
Can I use your MAC code? Yeah, it's a cyber I thought it was like a cybersecurity code. So do you need a MAC code for every... I don't know. There's a lot of things I wasn't too sure about. But anyway, then we see an angel being lifted into the loft.
Yeah, and we have a New York City ballet joke. And I kind of wanted to be like, people on the New York City ballet are super strong.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure who you're making fun of here.
Don't disrespect dancers.
And then Sam, I kind of like Sam's move of like kicking the statue or the sculpture
so
to have
in.
It come back in.
Well, first Molly tries to bring it in, then Sam tries to push her out the window. But yeah. And then he kicks the angel so it swings in. And then Carl shows up because thruple.
And can't believe how beautiful the place is. And I will say there's a very impressive mirror shot where like we're actually looking into a mirror.
Yes, I noticed
that.
That's
hard to do. Yeah, especially back in the day.
Yeah, I never noticed like really well done cinematography moments just because I don't have that eye. But I really did notice that. And I didn't write it down because I said, Mike will talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Molly starts showing Carl a sculpture she just finished. So Molly is probably an artist.
Yes.
But she hates Sam's chair.
Hates the ugly chair, but maybe they'll paint it.
Yeah, very wagon wheel table from When Harry Met Sally.
Yeah, I thought the same thing. Mm-hmm. And now they're in bed and we have that sort of like, are you okay? And what's the matter? Are you worried about the promotion? Is it moving in together?
Yeah, there's a cat.
Oh, I know there is a cat. I don't know if I saw it at this point, but I definitely saw it later.
Yeah, I saw it at the end of the bed. Yeah, she's gently playing with his belly button while she's asking him what's worrying him. And
I don't know. It's a lot of things. I just don't want the bubble to burst. Seems like whenever anything good in my life happens, I'm just afraid I'm going to lose it.
I love you. I really love you.
Ditto.
And we have our first I love you ditto, mm-hmm. which I guess is from Bruce and his high school girlfriend, that she would say I love you and he would always say ditto back.
Mm. Bruce has attachment issues.
Yeah, I guess so. We have something about a plane crash, like we do see footage of a plane crash and he should cancel his flight because these always happen in threes. And she refers to him as having a charmed life.
Yeah, so I don't know if this was like foreshadowing to... It's not going to be the plane that gets you, Sam.
And I do think there's something about this always happen in threes. Mm-hmm. And I also think that Charmed Life is a Macbeth reference.
And also a song by Third Eye Blind.
Correct. And we fade to the main room where she's working on her pottery.
Yeah.
And the turntable is changing. Oh, yeah. We have a lot of turning things. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a recurring. We have like records turning. We have like the pottery wheel turning. There's a lot of that happens in this film. And I wrote Unchained Melody starts, so we know this scene is going to be iconic.
Yeah, Unchained Melody, which actually I didn't realize this, originally was written about like prisoners, like unchained.
Oh, I don't think that I knew that.
Yeah.
And she, apparently Molly was originally going to be a sculptor, which makes sense because we have those big pieces. But Jerry Zucker tells the story of being, I think they were working on the score for Naked Gun and there was like a pottery magazine there, like a magazine that mentioned pottery. And so he sort of said to Bruce, what if she does pottery instead? And in real life, Bruce's wife is a potter. So he was like, well, okay, I know about that world. We can definitely make that happen.
Yeah. And even though she shows a sculpture that she did a scene ago.
Yeah, so maybe she does mixed, you know.
Media.
Exactly.
Yeah, and then Sam comes down and she tells him she can't sleep, so she's pottering.
And there are a lot of bowls in the background.
Oh, I didn't notice the bowls.
Oh, so many. There's just like shelves and I'm like, you've made enough bowls.
Yeah. sell those. Yeah, then Sam puts his dumb hand in and ruins it.
And this was not planned. This was an ad-libbed moment that they were just sort of fooling around. And it, and so him saying, I hope I didn't ruin your masterpiece, and her saying, well, it's not anymore. And that was just, okay, you know, Patrick and Demi talking. And then we have, it's funny because I had made the note of, like, you know, we have the two of them sculpting and getting very messy. And, like, I get that it's also very sensual, but it, of course, in my mind, I'm just like, oh my gosh, our hands are so dirty. And that we do then immediately cut to them being completely clean.
Yeah, I just wrote down, and they are sexily making a sex vase. I hope they don't have sex because that's going to dry really weird. She's trying to make a vase, Sam. Because, like, she's trying. Yeah. It reminds me of, like, sometimes when I'm doing something, I'm in the middle of doing, and this isn't a unique experience. I know this happens to a lot of people. Like, I'll be cleaning something or brushing my teeth, or and Mark's like, I'm going to give you a hug and make this romantic. And I'm like, not now.
This is not the time.
This is not the time. And now I said, oh no, they are now having muddy segs. Wait, when did they wash their hands?
Yeah, so there was a scene that was written but never filmed that was a bridge between the sculpting scene and the next scene, which is one of two times that this was supposed to be just a straight up, like, sex scene. And it was just sort of determined, like, I actually think it would be more powerful if it's just the two of them together, sort of like dancing and certainly being affectionate, but we're not actually going to get to a sex scene. And in fact, I think that Demi Moore had not agreed to a sex scene, and they were in the middle of, like, finding a body double for her that was going to film the sex scene instead, when they made the decision of, like, what if it's just not? What if it's just the two of them being affectionate? And I do think that it works better.
And Mike Jensen was busy that day.
I didn't have any time that day to I always fill in for Demi when I can.
Well, and I wrote here that I don't think there's going to be a meet cute here, and maybe we misunderstood the assignment.
There are a few of these that aren't going to quite work for our post-show wrap-up. And I do like that they sort of, like, fall into bed, and then we see the record change, and I wanted the next record to be, like, the Monster Mash.
Yeah. It was a mash. Doo-doo. We're back at Sam's job, which this is about to answer my questions. My own notes are answering my questions, because I was so confused, spoiler alert, as to why didn't Carl already have everything he needed from Sam? But just now I have, Sam is having a hard time with the Mac accounts. Carl can't get into some accounts because Sam changed the Mac codes because there's too much money in the accounts, but I still don't know what Sam does. So right here we find out that Sam has changed the codes.
Yes, and I wrote more numbers, big numbers.
Yeah.
But having no idea what, I don't understand this world at all. And yeah, we find out that Sam changed it because he wanted to nose around a little bit. And can you keep a secret? There's too much money in these accounts. And Carl offers to try to figure it out. And Sam says it's like a vendetta now. And then Carl asks what Sam and Molly are doing tonight, and they're going to go see Macbeth, and he thinks she just likes the guys in tights.
And I think, good thing they aren't in a theater, or there would be bad luck.
Yeah. And now we're at the Spring Street Repertory, which, as far as I could figure out, doesn't exist.
No, but I think it's definitely the Soho Playhouse.
100. Yeah. Yeah. I think it is as well. And we're walking down a quiet and messy Soho street. And it
Prince
is
Street.
One of those wild things. Yeah, and it's one of those wild things of watching, seeing this neighborhood, because, you know, I moved to New York in the year 2000, and already at that point, like, Soho was completely cleaned up. I mean, like, Soho is, like, one of the richest neighborhoods in New York now, but it wasn't that long ago that it was like this, that it was very run down and sort of abandoned, like, it had been a factory neighborhood, and all the factories had left, and it was kind of a dilapidated, left-behind neighborhood in New York.
Well, also, though, even to this day, Soho at night isn't bustling.
That is true. It does sort of shut down. Like, I've been in Soho around, like, 7 or 8 when it's suddenly a completely different feeling neighborhood.
Because it's mostly, like, salons and shopping and even some galleries, but there's not a ton of restaurants and bars, which is what keeps a neighborhood active after hours. Molly is telling Sam that she's going to have two pieces in Melissa's gallery, and Sam thinks her work is beautiful, but it shouldn't matter what the New York Times thinks. Just what he thinks. And Sam, you're not a gallery owner. We don't even know what you do, so your opinion doesn't count.
And, you know, she wants to marry him, and she thinks they should just do it. And why don't you ever say that you love me?
Mm-hmm. He seems surprised by this, but they just had pottery sex, and she thinks they should do it. He says she never wanted to talk about it. She says he never says he loves her. He says ditto instead. And now we see a man lurking.
Yeah, I said creepy guy emerges from the shadows, and there's the brief moment of like, what should we do? And he says that he'll handle it, and this goes bad very quickly.
Yeah, he mugs Sam. Sam gives him his wallet. Then there's a struggle. Sam fights him because maybe he hit Molly, and then Molly's yelling for help. And I wrote, Mike, this isn't funny. And then there's a gunshot. Then Sam starts running. And then we see Molly and Bloody Sam out of 546, outside of 546 Broadway, which is now a Uniqlo.
Yeah, the gun goes off and the guy runs away and Sam runs after him and it seems like everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And I wrote, Sam comes back and this moment is incredibly well done. Like, I feel like, I mean, it's in the preview. So if you've seen the preview, you know what's going to happen here. But I do think it's a very, very well handled moment. And she's calling for help. And we have the two men who approach. And we have an interesting series of cuts here. Because now we cut to Sam waking up in bed, calling out for Molly. And then we see the angel is in bed next to him, which is what they get for putting a creepy angel sculpture in their apartment. Mm-hmm. And we see it fall to the ground, and then Molly's in bed, and we hear her voice in the background as a light appears, and now we're back in the street, and the light is there. And we see them working on Sam, and Molly telling him not to leave. And we see him turn away from the light, and the light goes away, which is where you get the idea of, oh, that was his that was his chance to go, to go to whatever the next plane or whatever you want to call it. And because he turns away from it, that chance disappears.
Oh, I didn't get that. I just thought Sam is going to the light. He is being sprinkled with stardust.
And now we're with the ambulance and then in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. And this is, I feel, the first time we get a Miss Jensen that I was like, all right, we have the same last name, Molly and I.
Oh, I didn't even hear it there. I didn't get it till later. Okay.
Yeah, this is the first time I have a Miss Jensen here.
Okay. Yeah, and they are in the hospital. Ghost Sam is just watching everything. He should do something funny and ghostly. That's what I thought.
Well, he's sitting next to his body, and a man approaches and asks what happened to him.
Do you know this man?
Phil Leeds, emergency room ghost. Well, he has 120 credits, but is there a more important credit than Sammy Pinker's in Beaches?
No, there isn't. That's the one that I hope that you... You know what? I'm not going to say that this man deserves to be a ghost, but he did not give CeCe Bloom the job. He gave it to the girl who can walk on her hands.
Very true. What kind of taste does this guy have?
Yeah.
And he's waiting for his wife because she's fighting for it, I think is what he says. Mm-hmm. And he looks through the blankets and says, gunshot, that'll get you every time. And I'm like, well, it won't necessarily get you every time.
Come on. Yeah. And then he watches someone else die from across the room and then he disappears.
Yeah. May as well get used to it. You may be here for a while. And I do have questions as to whether or not we get the idea that, I guess, this guy also rejected the light and is sticking around. And is he waiting for his wife, who he's also going to convince to stick around? Or maybe he just... I don't know. I had questions for this character. I would go into this character deeper if I could.
Yeah, I don't know ghost rules. Like, I don't know if once you've gone into the light, if you're allowed to come down from the light.
I don't think so.
Is it like the layers of Mormon heaven?
The layers of heaven in Mormon. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Where you can, like, come down, but you can't go up?
Yeah, I'll tell you a secret. Doors ain't as bad as you think. Zip zap, ain't nothing at all. You'll see, you'll catch on. He ain't gonna make it. I've seen it a million times. He's a goner. You see? Here they come. Lucky bastard. It could have been the other ones. You never know.
Which is also a bit of a foreshadow here. And we see this man rise out of his body. And then, yeah, the ghost is gone and they're wheeling Sam's body away. And he sort of sees through the orderly. And I do, you know, we have a God help me moment. I do feel like there are some gods in here that are meant to be a double meaning. Mm. So there you go. For $4 a month, you get access to everything we've recorded, and we put out new material pretty much every week. You can find us on the Patreon app by searching We Couldn't Help But Wonder, the link on our Instagram, or through our website, wecouldn'thelpbutwonder.com. You'll also get instructions on how to receive the episodes wherever you already listen to podcasts. Hope you join us. Oh, goodness.
Sorry, I've been dusting.
Dusting. Have you been knocking down this apartment with them?
Yeah, I've been, yeah. But I did not find a Indian head penny in a jar from 1898.